everybody here?
Trying to move.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Okay. Inland Bays.
Good afternoon again. My name's Ed Lewandowski. I'm the executive director of the Center for the Inland Bays. And on behalf of our board, Chris and I would like to thank you for affording us the opportunity to appear before you today for this presentation about buffers. It's campaign season. You don't need to be reminded of that. You walk out these doors, go a half a block in any direction, you are reminded. And I think that we, for the past 2 years, have been on a campaign of our own. And that campaign has been to promote a more conservative buffer strategy for our Inland Bays watershed. We have been from this council chamber up to Dover and back on a couple of occasions, sharing information about the need for and the efficacy of buffers. And I'm delighted that you're taking the opportunity today to listen to some of that same information. And what I'd like to do is quickly review for you some background about the Center for the Inland Bays. Unfortunately, it's been my experience after 10 years working for the organization that there are a lot of misconceptions out there about us, who we are, what we are, how we do things, and why we do things. So I've got a few slides that I've prepared that I think will aptly describe the organization to you, and then Chris is going to get into the heart of the presentation. We are a national estuary program. Congress created the National Estuary Program back in 1987 when they amended the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. We know it as the Clean Water Act. In 1988, we were nominated, our Inland Bays Estuary, that is, was nominated for inclusion in this program. The purpose of the National Estuary Program is to identify, restore, and protect nationally significant estuaries of the United States. We have a program in San Juan Bay in Puerto Rico and all the way out to Puget Sound in Washington State. Currently, there are 28 local estuary programs in the NEP. After the program was included, for a period of several years, a large group of Inland Bay stakeholders collaborated on the development of a management plan for the Inland Bays. And that is this plan right here, the Inland Bays Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan. This plan was adopted by the state in 1994. Sussex County is a signatory to this management plan. And the plan included an objective of creating the Center for the Inland Bays. And in 1995, the General Assembly passed House Bill 540, the Inland Bays Watershed Enhancement Act, which created the center as a nonprofit organization. We are administered under Section 320 of the Clean Water Act. National management for the program is provided by the EPA, which really makes us a state-enabled private entity that's administered by the federal government. And if you don't think that's a challenge, let me tell you.
Who signs your check?
I do.
You sign your own check.
That's correct.
All right, cool. Yeah. Where do you get your money?
We have the benefit, actually, because of that structure, of enjoying funding from Section 320. Funding Congress appropriates, and through the Department of Interior. We have a state line item that comes through the Division of Water Resources, and then we go out and we can secure money from private donations, trusts, foundations, charitable grants.
Great. Okay, thanks.
Our Board of Directors, you may know some of these people, Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of DENREC, it was mentioned earlier. Mr. Baker, our County Administrator, is a member of our board. We have an appointee of the Speaker of the House, and that appointee is Pat Campbell-White. Appointee of the Senate Pro Tem, which is Mr. Rick Akel. They may change in a couple weeks here, depending on what happens. Have a rep from the Sussex Conservation District, a representative from the Sussex County Association of Towns. Right now that representative is Mayor Del Tush from Dewey Beach. And we have two standing committees, a Citizens Advisory Committee and a Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee. And the chairman of those committees sit on our board of directors. Our mission is to promote the wise use and enhancement of Delaware's inland bays and their associated watersheds, and it's to oversee the implementation of the Inland Bays CCNP. And we do that through four core program areas. It's restoration, education, research, and public policy. And that public policy initiative is the reason we're here today, to try to help you to understand our thoughts and our ideas about a buffer strategy for the watershed. I'm going to turn the floor over to Chris Basin. Chris is a science coordinator with the Center for the Inland Bays, and he has been our principal on the development of our buffer strategy.
How many employees do you guys have total?
Currently 7. We just saw Jim Alderman. Maybe you know him. Jim retired after 10 years of service to the Center for Inland Bays.
Okay, great. Hey, Chris.
Thank you. A little bit about myself before I start up. I live in Ocean View, and I have a degree from University of Delaware, and I have a master's degree from East Carolina University, which is in North Carolina. And my career has been spent studying wetlands, studying streams. I've been involved in policy, worked for the Nature Conservancy for a little bit, and for 3 years I've been working with the center. And I spent a lot of time putting together the report that you have. I have 2 extra copies here. I'll present them to the chairman.
Anybody need them? Anybody need a copy?
If not, somebody else might feel free to.
There you go.
Forgot mine.
And if y'all want, I'm going to be putting up quite a bit of data on the screen. Feel free to move forward so you can see it as best as you can if you like. But I prepared a real short opening remark. I don't usually write out stuff, but I just want to kind of set the stage for presentation of this report with this remark. I have here that wetlands and streams that feed the inland bays are important not just because of their flood control functions and for the fish and wildlife habitat they provide, but to a large degree, they actually control the quality of the waters in the inland bays. Healthy wetlands and waterways filter more pollution, and the healthier our wetlands and streams, then the better the water quality in the bays. Protecting wetlands and waterways with buffer is the single best means to accomplishing this that I'm aware of. And this is reflected in the fact that recently we've had more conservative buffer strategies appear in Maryland, Virginia, and New Jersey. It's also reflected in the fact that there's been quite a bit of federal assistance for providing buffers on agricultural lands. But not all water bodies are the same, and not all counties are the same. A buffer system that's appropriate for Maryland is not necessarily appropriate for Sussex because we have a different landscape and we have different social and political concerns. And understanding that is really the key, I believe, to implementing buffers. So what I'm going to present to you today are recommendations for a water quality buffer system that was designed specifically for the Inland Bays watershed. The recommendations are based on a lot of regional science, a lot of local science as well, and they take into account the fact that we need substantial reductions in nitrogen and phosphorus if we do want to restore the bays to their natural productive state. And it also takes into account that a buffer system has got to be flexible to be accommodated by development. So, a quick state of the bays. We had a lot of cleanup in the 70s and 80s. Most of that was due to wastewater treatment plant upgrades. But since early 1990s to the present, we haven't had any significant increases, and we haven't had any significant decreases in the levels of nitrogen and phosphorus. So we're basically holding our own, as far as pollutants go, at a moderately to highly polluted state. This year, we had 9 fish kills in the watershed total. That's actually a big year for fish kills. It's not the best indicator, but it does show you that the oxygen in our waters is being used up by all these nutrients, and it's not very good habitat for fish. So I want to get into the meat of the talk now. What I'll do is tell you how we went about developing this buffer system. We focused on science from the Atlantic coastal plain. We tried to avoid any science from places like the Piedmont, where there's hills, there's a different geology. I want to talk about the different water body types that we've developed buffers for, and I want to apply our recommendations to randomly selected developments that were submitted to PLUS, and then show you how we refined our recommendations based on what we learned by doing that. And the first thing I want to do is just give you a visual of what an intact buffer is. This is a site on Love Creek. This is a tidal area, and this is a forested buffer here outlined next to the creek. It's probably about 100 foot or more. And that's basically what a buffer is. It's a natural area between active land uses like development and our surface waters. And buffers are managed for 3 primary functions: the sustainable removal and reduction of pollutants, to protect wetlands and waterways from physical encroachment during development and afterwards, and also to allow water bodies to maximize their own natural capacities to reduce pollution. A stream isn't just a pipe that goes to the estuary. It's actually a biological reactor. And all the water and the nutrients moving down that stream interact with that stream, and they can be taken up. The healthier the stream is, the better it performs that function. Here's a diagram that shows you how buffers filter and remove pollution. What you're seeing up here, sorry for the color being a little faded, but this is a riparian area, which means basically a waterway, and it's wetlands next to it. And this is an upland land use right here. You got your active land use. The active land uses closest to that stream are critical because they contribute nutrients very quickly with little time for processing. But nutrients also are entering this riparian area from active land uses that are farther away. They move through the groundwater, for instance. And it can take sometimes 20 years for nitrogen from these areas out here to actually reach the stream. So it's interesting to think that you can apply a buffer now that will treat pollution that began 20 years ago. So when you install a buffer, what happens is that source of nutrients right next to the stream is eliminated. The trees begin to filter the nutrients that remain. And those trees also address what's coming from the land uses further away. The buffer there supplies structure to this stream, which increases the nutrient processing of that stream itself. So those are how those three functions work. Now, that's just a riparian area, and this is probably better presented in your report. There's a lot of other different types of wetlands and waterways in the watershed itself, and they all function a little bit different because they receive their water and their pollutants from different sources. You got your headwaters, which are in tight connection with the surrounding land use. Those are the numerous streams that tend to occur in the upper parts of the watershed up here. You got your larger streams, which I just went over. They tend to support streamside wetlands, which filter waters that floods out. And you got your flats and depressional wetlands, which are very numerous as well. They're not even connected to the surface water drainage network. So they just get precipitation as their inputs and pollutants associated with that. Finally, salt marshes. They're controlled by the tides, and they move inland. And people interact with these wetlands differently. People want a view over a salt marsh, but most people don't really care. New homeowners, they don't care to see out across their ditch. So there's different considerations for different wetland types, and we've taken that into consideration. In general, water quality buffers are highly effective. For nitrogen, they've been found in the coastal plain to remove anywhere from 70 to 90% of nitrogen inputs. They're more variable for removing phosphorus inputs, but they're capable of removing very high levels of phosphorus inputs, 81%. They're very efficient. You don't need much maintenance. Just trim them back, and they sit there, and they perform their function year after year. But they're also variable, and the meat of this presentation is discussing their variability, so that's what I want to get into now. We're going to be focusing on extent, the type of vegetation in the buffer, and the buffer width, the characteristics or design of a buffer, basically. And for the extent, it's an easy question. What wetlands should be deserving of a buffer? Scientifically, the answer to that is simple, and that's all wetlands and waterways are deserving of some sort of buffer. Reason being is that wetlands are basically the only place on your landscape where you get that nutrient reduction function and that wildlife habitat, so they're highly valuable, and that's why they should all be protected to some extent. What's the most important wetland to protect? That would be another question. Answer to that would be the headwaters. Reason being, they comprise 75% of all waterway length in the watershed. And that might sound a little counterintuitive, but the way I like to present that is think of a tree. If you add up all those little tiny branches of a tree together, that total length, it's going to be a lot more than these larger branches here that are akin to like the larger waterways. So think of the headwaters as all these little branches. They're very numerous in the landscape. Another way to think about it is three out of every four streams is a headwater. And you can see that in this watershed diagram here. So nature kind of repeats itself. But there's other reasons, too. Headwaters tend to have the highest nutrient concentrations of all of our streams. And if you want to treat pollution, you do it at its source. So you treat it where the pollutants are the most concentrated. And rates of nitrogen removal in headwater streams are higher. This diagram illustrates why. Headwaters are real shallow.
And the water flowing down them interacts with this blue area on the sides and the bottom of the stream channel. That's what we call the area of maximum nutrient processing. So more of the water flows through that area. In the larger streams over here, a lot of that water is just flowing downstream without interacting with the maximum nutrient processing very much. So it's part of the geometry of the channels that makes them more effective as well. So vegetation type is part of ordinances. It's been discussed very much. And basically in the literature, it comes down to two types of vegetation. You have your forested buffers or your grass buffer. Your turf grass buffer is basically your default in a developed landscape. If it's not woods, it's going to be grass. The question is, what type would be most effective? And what a wide review, this is a national review, found, the data in this review found that on average, forested buffers remove 36% more nitrogen than do grass buffers. And the reason is simply because forested buffers take the nutrients up in their biomass, whereas the grass buffers, they take up a little bit of nutrients and they release. They take up and then they release. Forested buffers hold it for longer. There's also more organic matter in forests than there are in turf grass. Organic matter is a critical ingredient in removing nitrogen. And finally, if you take a look at B, picture B here, you see how complex that forest is. This stream here is filled with branches, it's filled with packs of leaves, and it's very sinuous and tortuous. Stream up here is simplified, it just kind of shoots the water downstream. So having that greater amount of interaction with the biology down there removes more nitrogen as the waters flow down the stream. So that's another reason why forested buffers are more important. And that's what we recommend is forested buffers. This is sort of your default setting for what a buffer would be. Out here is your marsh, this is your tree line. And if you don't have vegetation requirements, this is what you'll get in most cases. And you'll actually get fertilization within this buffer, which is, you know, really contrary to the purpose of the buffer. The question of buffer width is probably the most controversial because, you know, it takes up land. It affects how site development can be done. The first question you want to ask with buffer width is, where do you buffer from? And sort of the options that you have in most ordinances are, do you buffer from a stream channel? Or, if present, do you buffer from the upland wetland boundary? You know, some streams will have wetlands right adjacent to them. And the answer, if you want to maximize nutrient reduction, is you protect the entire ecosystem with that buffer. Because the stream interacts with the wetland to reduce pollution. So you want to buffer the whole thing by beginning from the upland wetland boundary. In some cases, we have proposed by the state and the Sussex County Ordinance also has a 50-foot buffer from perennial streams. But if that stream has a 50-foot wetland right beside it, you get no additional protection. And I did a little survey. In 21 nine-paddle waterways, the wetlands were 112-foot wide from the channel to the upland edge. So the wetlands that do occur on our streams are pretty wide. And this is sort of an illustration of what I just spoke about. I'll run through this pretty quick. Here's your channel. Here's your 50-foot buffer. As you can see, in some cases, it doesn't get past the riparian wetland. But if you buffer here from the edge of the upland, you can protect the existing upland forest. What we did in answering the question, how wide should a buffer be, is we looked at 17 studies that compared buffer width on your x-axis here with percent nitrogen removal on your y-axis. And the general idea is what we see is that as you increase your width, removal efficiency occurs, but it's not a one-to-one relationship. It starts to peter out after some point. In analyzing this data, we found that there was a break at 150 feet, where buffers over 150 feet were very consistently reducing very high amounts, anywhere from 80 to 90% of the nitrogen coming in. Below 150 feet, there was quite a bit of variability, and buffers reduced less. So that was one of the marks that we took, 150-foot buffer. This is for phosphorus. I only found 6 studies for the coastal plain. I had 17 studies for the coastal plain for nitrogen. So for phosphorus, I had to look at a lot of wider studies. This is a national graph here. Same thing. You see there's a lot more variability with phosphorus, but it's the same general trend. And what we found at around 80 feet, there was a point where above which variability in phosphorus removal decreased. they were more consistent in removing more phosphorus, below which there was a lot more variability. So that 80 feet was a mark that we picked as well. And I'll explain why we're choosing two marks a little further in. So moving on, different wetland type entirely, totally different set of considerations. We all know why salt marshes are extremely important. I don't need to go over that. But I do want to go over how salt marshes respond to rising sea levels. They're going to move inland. This is the general concept of this, this being the uplands here, this being the marsh here, and then this being the bay. As sea level rises, the marsh is going to migrate over the upland, and the bayward edge of the marsh here is going to erode. And you're all familiar with how that occurs around the inland bays. So there's that process of removal, or movement. And that's just going to continue on over the span of decades. That's just what nature does. When a development is built in the path of that marsh, what happens is nature doesn't pay any attention. It just keeps going. The marsh keeps moving, and the bayward edge keeps eroding. Development starts to get wet feet as the marsh interacts with it, and they protect their property by stabilizing that boundary with riprap or something like that, filling in. They might even do that at development. And then the marsh continues to erode on the bayward edge, and you start to lose marsh because it's got nowhere to go. So that's the only way a marsh can maintain itself is by migrating inland. But if you provide a buffer there, you can at least delay that situation for a certain amount of time. This is an actual aerial photo of that. This is Slough's Gut. And this is a low marsh right here. Spartina grasses grow out here, cord grass. This is the high marsh where you get some bushes and stuff. But what I want to point out to you in this, and you actually see it very well, are these little white toothpicks. These are the dead trees that have died because that marsh has moved in. And if you go out here in that marsh and you dig down a little bit under the organic matter of the marsh, you'll find the old forest floor as this marsh has moved over it. So you can see here how that is progressing. And that's another ground shot of the trees that are very common around any marsh in this area. Now, this is out of Quillen's Point. You see homes have been constructed right on the marsh, and this marsh is eroding here, but it's got nowhere to go, so we're losing that particular marsh. Just more pictures of how the process occurs. Here's riprap at the upland wetland boundary. So just some more evidence as to what happens. Now, we're very fortunate in our watershed to have actual data out of the University of Delaware that quantifies the rates of marsh movement inland. And you can imagine how you might be able to use those rates. But this is a 1926 aerial photo. It's up here at Guinea Creek. The red line is the marsh upland boundary. This is the bay shore here. And I've highlighted a few areas that I want you to look at. Wendy Carey, who still works with the university, she took a look at all these different aerial photos. And we're going to transition now from 1926 to 1968. So just keep your eye on those areas. Keep your eye on those boundaries. So you can see some of the changes now between 26. That's about 40 years of change. Up here, you had quite a lot of movement of that marsh. Here, you had very little movement of the marsh. Here, you had about 250 feet of movement over that 40 years. And I want to go back and show that to you one more time, just so you can get an idea. Watch this up here. It's just not moving very much. Whereas that really changed a lot. And here's a side-by-side comparison of that, just as another view. The reason this one moved quite a bit is that it had a gradually sloping upland. It was an upland with a shallow slope next to that wetland, so it migrated very quickly. The other one didn't move because the slopes of the upland were steep, so that wetland had nowhere to go. So slope controls the rate of wetland migration. This is some of how Wendy characterized her sites. These are transects that she put. Each line is a different year, just to show you how the data was processed. And these are the rates of migration that she calculated for Indian River Bay and Rehoboth Bay. Gradual slopes are less than 8%. Steep slopes are more than 8%. And the rates are actually surprising, especially for gradual slopes, anywhere from 5 to 6 feet of migration a year. Steep slopes is about 1 foot.
Chris, would subsidence have anything to do with accelerating some of that also?
it would play a part in how they move. And locally, we have very high rates of subsidence in the mid-Atlantic around here. So you can take those rates and determine how long a buffer of a given width in this category here would last before the wetlands next to it migrated over it. And so the numbers that we have over here are those years by bay and by gradual and steep slope. So we've selected some numbers out of here, but this is a table for you to take a look at. And, you know, think about your planning horizons. And you can see that steep slopes, well, you don't need a very wide buffer. But for gradual slopes, if you want to protect things for nearly 100 years, you do, yes.
What is the difference between gradual and steep? How are you defining those?
I took that from Wendy's PhD thesis.
Okay.
Basically, she arbitrarily set a point based on what she saw from the field. So it was anything above 8% slope and below.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was asking.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And you can apply that over 100 feet next to the wetland into the upland. And I'll show you a little bit more about how that can be used. This here is Angola Neck. The white areas are tidal wetlands, and these are 2-foot elevation contours that were derived from 2005 LIDAR data. LIDAR is this high-precision radar data used to determine elevation. We're very fortunate to have that data. So you can see these elevation contours where they're very far spaced apart. That's a gradual slope, like right here. This is a gradual slope where wetlands will move fast. This is a steep slope right here where they won't be moving anywhere at all. You can use that information to make a map, which would show how wide a buffer would need to be to fit your planning horizon. And that's something that I would be willing to pursue if either the commission or council was interested in doing that. There are grant opportunities out there to produce that type of map in pretty short order, I think. Now, let's talk about sea level rise, because that's what's driving this whole thing. This is a graph of global sea level rise that was published recently in Science. These are the observed rates of sea level rise over the past 100 years, and this is what's predicted. Now, this has nothing to do with the question over what is causing global warming. This is semi-empirical data that shows that in the next 100 years, we're likely to have 2 to 5 times the rate of sea level rise than we had in the last 100 years. So for a coastal county like Sussex, for our watershed, this is highly significant. Next to it, also associated with a change in climate, is storm frequency. This is actual data from the last 100 years down in Virginia. They have a long-term ecological reserve down there they've been looking at. And about 1880, they had 10 storms a year. Now we're up to about 30 storms a year. So we expect that that will increase. So these are some of the factors that drive wetland migration. So probably the data that we presented previous is conservative data. But I think we are already starting to see some of the effects of that increasing sea level rise. These are marshes in Little Assholman Bay, and you can see the middle of these marshes is disappearing. They're basically drowning. So sea level is rising faster than they can keep up with it. And when I first realized this, I do a lot of work, and boy, it pissed me off. Because, you know, I hunt, I fish, I realize that these areas are fish nursery, they're duck habitat, and it's a little troubling to think, you know, wow, you know, we are experiencing these great rates of change. But, you know, I've since come to terms with that more, and I realize basically the only way we're going to be able to sustain our wetlands is by providing buffers for them to migrate into. Now, this isn't happening everywhere in our watershed, but there are places like this where the wetlands are submerging. So we're moving on to a different wetland type, flats and depressional wetlands that we've talked about there. 75% of our freshwater wetlands are flats and depressional wetlands. They're just flat. They don't have anywhere to drain. And they receive most of their precipitation and pollution from the atmosphere. We found very little information out there that would recommend a specific width. So basically, we arbitrarily chose 50 feet just to protect them from close groundwater inputs and from physical encroachment. That's pretty much arbitrary. I can't say anything more than that. And then this is our graph, our table, which shows how we've broken down these alternatives. We, of course, recommend all forested buffers, but we provide two alternatives. And we hope that these alternatives provide flexibility in implementation. The general thinking is that the adequate alternative perhaps could be worked into an ordinance, and the optimum alternative could be obtained with incentives if people were willing to do that, if they were interested in that. Everything here, I personally believe, isn't such a big deal, but I think a lot of people are going to have a tough time with that 300-foot next to the gradual upland wetland boundary. It's not a new precedent. New Jersey has 300-foot. Maryland has 200-foot buffers. But it is something that, you know, is necessary if you want to protect those wetlands. So,
for those durations.
Correct. Yes. So we applied both of those strategies to 11 randomly selected preliminary land use applications. Tried to stratify it so that we got some in the more well-drained portion of the watershed and some in the poorly drained area. And these purple areas are the developments that we selected and applied them to. Basically looking at how much buildable area did the buffer take up. What we found on that is that on average, the adequate alternative had 13.8% of buildable area or developable acreage as the buffer. For the optimum, it was 33.2%. So the adequate, we felt that really that was most of the time, that's well within the range of Sussex County open space requirements. And we would, of course, greatly encourage buffers be used as open space.
Buffers count as open space.
And, you know, and also as a natural amenity for the development. These aren't, you know, wildlife preserves. We would hope that people would interact with these areas. So the acreage of buffer was evenly split between non-tidal wetlands, tidal areas, and ditches. So ditches really became a problem, we realized. And we knew that going in, that buffering ditches would be a problem. So what we recommended is, where possible, fill in ditches if you don't need them, if it's not necessarily for hydrologic control. If they are, convert them to stormwater features would be another encouragement. And if they couldn't be buffered, or if they couldn't be filled in or converted, then we would recommend a smaller buffer width on ditches so that the development could accommodate the buffer. So we would recommend 35 feet on ditches. So that was a refinement of our recommendations, and that will take down quite a bit the actual percent of buildable area that we calculated and that we showed you in that last slide. So this is a development that, if our recommendations were applied, they would have some trouble, and this is, of course, in your report as well. This is an area near the salt pond, near Bethany, and it's got a gradually sloping upland next to a tidal wetland. And that 300 foot here would force most of the homes up into this area here. And from an aspect of resource protection, perhaps there's things that can be done with density, incentives. I don't know, that'd be kind of more on the other end of things, to figure out a way to, if desirable, preserve the resource and squeeze the houses in around it. They probably wouldn't want to go for incentives with the optimum alternative here just because the buffer would be too wide. That was one extreme where the buffers would have quite an impact. This is the other extreme. This is Bridlewood. The percent developable acreage in buffer here was not even 2%. And there's just a small tidal gut here and a couple small flats or depressional wetlands, and they probably don't even exist on the ground anymore anyway. So this is the other extreme. So again, ditches are key. If there's the width is reduced down to 30 feet on ditches, there should be very little problem applying this to developments. There might have to be, yes?
Is that tax ditches or the, you know, when? What kind of ditches are you talking about?
Any ditch that would be necessary on the site to continue draining the site.
We run into the problem with tax ditches, you know, that they have their own separate set of regulations, and even now we're dealing with, I guess, DENREC and Sussex Conservation saying, you know, they have a maintenance easement down the side of it, so you can't fill it in, and they're saying they don't want a buffer because they need to be able to have access to the ditch to drain it out. That's why I was wondering if that was, right, you know, naturally occurring ditches or quote-unquote tax ditches.
Yeah, well,
it's a real
I think
struggle.
In most of these instances, we've been considering the laterals, for instance, in the Little
Besselman Bay watershed,
okay,
where you have those 100
right.
yards on center.
Right, okay.
So there may be some opportunity to fill in those particular ditches.
Okay.
And they are being filled in a lot of development projects, particularly Millville by the Sea, I think, went through that process to fill in a lot of their ditches and convert some over. And, you know, you raise a really interesting point, which is sort of the question of variances and vegetation type, and that's something I didn't mention yet, but what we would also recommend is that those tax ditch easements, you know, to get the equipment in there remain. Perhaps they can be worked as trails by the water as well. Also, for tidal wetlands, people are going to want the view, and you can't take that away from the development, so you would have to put something in the ordinance to allow for viewscapes. There could be some specific management recommendations as well, or just ways to cut out the underbrush so they can see through the trees after the wetlands.
Is there something between forests and grass that would work? I mean, that's why I was thinking that very same thing, was that if you, I mean, the difference between the two is significant, and I was wondering if there was any kind of vegetation in the middle that maybe would not be a visual issue but would provide more filtering.
Like shrubs
or something, I mean.
Yeah, and I guess the question there would be, how would you maintain it as shrubs? I mean, there probably are some in-betweens. With forests, you can manage them so that you can see through the trees. What we see in the field is for a buffer that's not so wide, an 80-foot buffer, you could see through the trees. You have to sometimes manage the undergrowth in that woods. Another point I should make is that for the 300-foot buffers, we would only require forested vegetation for that first 80 feet. Outside of that first 80 feet, as long as there's no permanent structures in there, it could be managed however. That will be what we would recommend. And I think that's basically it. But to do something like this, you have to have enforcement as the key. And this is just an example of a site that was not enforced under the existing regulation. And you're standing in the bay here and looking up to two new homes there. So any regulation that is done has to be enforced, and that's a big part of it. And I should say that we have been working with Rick, and it's been a very fruitful partnership to see that, you know, we can do better inspection and better enforcement, and we're very happy that that has been occurring now. So it's good to know that that's going on. This report and what I've presented, it's been approved by our science committee. It's been peer reviewed, and it's for the inland bays watershed, but it could probably work in other coastal plain watersheds as well. So let me know if you got any questions, if there's anything I can describe to you further.
We're going to find out right now. I suspect there might be a few. Start down on this end. Couch, Mr. Lang, anything you
want to
ask?
Oh, just a thought. In the last meeting, actually, we've changed our philosophy on where the silt fence should go. And there's a buffer required. The silt fence is going to be upland of the buffer. It's not going to be on the in the buffer itself. And so that should be a benefit to protect the buffer.
Yeah, we're extremely pleased to see that, and certainly it's significant progress.
And that was a simple step, no matter where you put the fence.
I mean, when it occurs to you, it's just like such a no-brainer.
Yeah, right.
You know, it took us 10 years to think of that.
Well, they were putting them at the at the line where the wetland was, and they were disturbing the buffer. So
we need to credit Mr. Katz for really taking us out in the field and working with us on trying to identify some of these problems and bringing this concern.
And he's informed us, too, of where the couple of problems are. So we have some examples.
You know, the department's picked up on those issues and working real well with it.
Johnson?
Well, you gentlemen had the advantage of sitting through our entire meeting today, and perhaps the last one was of most interest to you. But, you know, the issue that we're struggling with, you know, of course, is what we're able to do or not able to do based on ordinances and state law, et cetera. My concern, has been and continues to be with, those headwaters that you've addressed in here, and because, that's the spider web. That's what spreads throughout our county and impacts that. And What's your take on the difference between the state wetlands and these 404 wetlands and the need for protection of those wetlands?
I hate to interrupt just real quick, but if you can come to the podium, sorry.
Yeah, we need to.
No, you totally.
They are. I mean, they do act as one continuous unit, and they'll be, you know, sea level rise will impact them the same. The tidal will move into the 404, and the 404 will move on to the upland, and that's just the process. So, the whole wetland unit should be buffered, and that's really, you know, providing protection to salt marshes and not to freshwater wetlands next to them. I believe it's just this old relic of old policy that it got, you know, cut up and hacked up over time. I mean, basically, those wetlands all have important functions, so I believe that they all should be protected.
Why do we differentiate between state and federal wetlands in the first place?
Well,
I know.
The federal, state has authority, as well as the federal, do over salt marshes. But the state has no authority because they have no law for freshwater wetlands. So the Corps is the only body in Sussex County that I'm aware of that has authority over freshwater wetlands.
I think the issue was years ago that there are maps showing the state wetlands. The Corps would allow some improvements within the 404 wetlands, so there wasn't a buffer requirement. That was the basis of it.
Because it does, I mean, it makes perfect sense what you're saying to consider it as a unit. I mean, it isn't, it's politically divided. It's not naturally or divided.
Right.
Yeah.
Functionally divided.
Yeah.
How about the little pockets of wetlands out in the middle of a project that may be.
Right. Good question. I mean,
100 by 100
know.
Or something like that. It's just a piece of wet spot that's really not necessarily a wetland. But
yeah. And if you buffered that with a 50-foot buffer, you'd have a 2-foot wetland with a, you know.
Yeah, right.
And that's a big issue because with 50 feet, that's a pretty big area.
My thinking is, and I know this happens up in Newcastle, is those little areas are filled in when development occurs. And, as you know, up to a certain size, that's just the nature of the problem. What are you going to do? You know, that's just how it is. But I think that you can set a threshold for wetland size. You could maybe base it on the area of the wetland being buffered and the area of the buffer itself, maybe try to find a relationship between the distribution of wetland size and that ratio, and you could come up with something that would have at least empirical evidence behind it as to why you made your decision as to what would be buffered and would not be buffered.
But with those little pockets, do they also serve as assisting in the and the recharge of water and the filtration of those nutrients out of the?
Yeah, they do. I mean, a pocket wetland like that, the size of this area here, I mean, it'll receive precipitation, filter that precipitation. It'll hold flood water and precipitation water in the winter months. And in the summer months, the spring, it'll also provide water to the drinking water aquifer that is clean water. So that's part of their function. It's also important for amphibian habitat. They are important, but in a developed landscape, I think it's kind of like how much can you hope to feasibly preserve? There's got to be some kind of threshold, I suppose.
Chris, I think you touched on it, but maybe if you could emphasize it a little bit more. I think most people assume that most of the pollution that goes into the water is from surface water. But I think in your report, most of it comes from groundwater.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, and especially in Rehoboth Bay, the land is so sandy, it has such high infiltration that groundwater moves very fast into the soil, so it doesn't run off as surface water very much. We do have surface water in the streams and the ditches, especially during rain events, but certain times of the year, Rehoboth Bay gets something like 75% of its water and nitrogen load from groundwater. So that bay particularly is driven by groundwater flow.
And that's important when we start talking about some of our favorite spare ribs. That ends up being groundwater that goes directly into the bays, right?
Yeah, it's a groundwater dominated system.
And that is, you're right, many people don't realize that. And in the engineering community, depending who you're talking to, some they tend to focus more on surface water runoff and discharge. And that makes sense because that's what they're managing their stormwater for and all that. But there has been a lot of just coming up to speed and understanding it more, and that's why they have these green technology stormwater features that provide infiltration and all that.
And am I correct in that also in talking about the benefits of the buffers, that number one, there can be an immediate benefit in terms of the reduction of those nutrients. Number two, it can assist in the next 10 to 20 years in terms of reduction of those nutrients. And thirdly, perhaps for the benefit of the developers themselves, by providing the buffers, it can help prevent the encroachment of those wetlands into those lots that are plotted right up against the wetlands.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it is it's a flood control, it's a public safety, it's a societal cost issue as well, I think. Because the people that are moving into the houses, they don't know, they don't understand that the sea is coming towards them.
So from the perspective of a development that perhaps is going to take a while to be developed, by having a forested-type buffer, it actually can protect those lots that are currently adjoining those wetlands from eventually having to take some type of additional expense to protect them from the further encroachment of those migrating wetlands.
Yes, yeah.
I missed that one, gentlemen. Oh, my. I wasn't privy to that information prior to that public hearing.
That's one of the dangers of having something hang around too long, because you kind of tend to forget when you learned something.
Yep.
If you got public sewer, and you got people to stop putting fertilizer on their lawns, what else is there that's gonna pollute? Because what I'm thinking about is the idea that maybe this is bogus. I ask you this question: if you have a subdivision adjacent to a wetlands that's going to have on-site disposal, is that would seem to me in my mind that that's a much bigger problem than a subdivision that's going to have a central sewer where it's being processed somewhere else. Is that so, or am I thinking about that the right way?
I've always been told that septic systems are designed to fail.
Everything's designed to fail.
So, over time.
Just a question of when.
Exactly.
Come on, you're an engineer, you know that.
I'm not an engineer, but my brother is, and I didn't sleep at Holiday Inn.
I stayed at Holiday Inn Express last night. I'm not an engineer either. But.
No, certainly, yeah, we know the county has made tremendous progress and has made a concerted effort to expand the sewer districts and has taken 15,000 to 18,000 septic systems offline, and that is actually one of the objectives that is in our management plan, so we appreciate that. I think in response to your question, yeah, if we get the homeowners to reduce fertilizer contributions to their lawns, if we can find ways to adequately treat sewage, that's going to be significant reductions to our nutrient contributions to our estuary. But again, we're trying to treat some of the sins of the past, and these groundwater flow paths where they come up,
right,
enter our streams and our headwater streams in many, many places.
Just so you know, where I was not going with that is to suggest that there should be one buffer for one and one for the other. I think the buffers are important. I'm just thinking of what the next step beyond imposing a buffer is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I'm trying to anticipate is what the what some of the objections might be. The one thing that I think we need to be careful of, though, is usually when these things come down to an ordinance, there's a great tendency to want to simplify it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just isn't that simple, and I don't think you're going to be able to have one size fits all. What we're going to have is something like what's been proposed here. And, if the average person may have a little difficulty understanding why it's the way it is, but it probably still needs to be that way. thing.
Can I ask another question?
Sure, you can ask all you want.
Who's working with the homeowners associations to help them understand the best practices for maintenance or their responsibilities for maintenance and what makes up a good buffer area? And just, I mean, we were talking earlier about can you do shrubs instead of grass and stuff. And it seems to me if the homeowners associations were aware of forest management as an option where you can selectively cut out trees that are dead or dying or damaged or whatever, and you can clear shrub and stuff that are invasive species and things like that, for the most part, you can end up with a fairly porous, visually porous buffer that you can see through that still functions fairly as it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. But people have to understand what's a good tree to keep and which ones to take out and when and that kind of stuff. And I don't see anybody, maybe I'm ignorant about it, but I don't see anybody really helping homeowners associations with those kinds of issues.
Well, we are starting to. Okay. We've recently begun to collaborate with the Sussex Conservation District and with DENREC to offer workshops for homeowners associations. Our Citizens Advisory Committee, in a policy meeting Mr. Johnson attended the other day, the committee has decided that they're going to make that one of their priorities to begin to focus on those HOAs. I know DENREC recently compiled a list of those HOAs. That in itself was difficult to obtain for a number of years. So there is a renewed emphasis on trying to work with the HOAs, not only to teach them about buffers, but also to look at the stormwater management responsibilities that many of them are unaware of.
Anybody down on this side, feel free to jump in. It's a
no question. Just appreciate the information.
It's an open mic.
Absolutely.
Open mic. Okay.
That was pretty open.
Yeah, that's true. Gentlemen, we really appreciate the work that your team has done. It is important. This body does not pass ordinances. I think we do have the capacity to inspire some. And since we have a mandate and the resources to follow through on the land use plan and, with the ordinances, I don't think there's anybody in this room that sees any reason why it shouldn't be done. So,
well, thank you. Again, we appreciate the opportunity.
And it's quite likely that we'll call on you again for
we'd be delighted to continue to work with you. I don't know how many of you have read a book by Malcolm Gladwell called The Tipping Point. It's sort of been our strategy here. We've tried to reach enough people at the county level, with the administration, with the staff, planning and zoning, with the council members, and at the state to begin to develop some understanding and consideration about what we really need to do with this issue.
This is the smart stuff we need. The hatchet is not the tool we need to be using.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Have you all entertained any consideration to approaching some of the engineering firms and potential developers about how to incorporate the use of buffers in their projects that can result in a superior buffer that can obviously positively impact the water quality and the watershed?
That's a great suggestion, Chris. I know you've had some contact and phone calls possibly with members of the development community. The simple answer is no.
And that might take some of that adversarial piece off,
yeah.
And so that they view you as more as a resource rather than an adversary, and the net result is that we all benefit from it. Maybe you all might benefit some financially through donations when they see that, you're not the evildoers of anti-development.
Again.
But in fact, as Chris talked about, there's varying degrees of buffers based on the layout of the land and what the slope is and how they could incorporate that, when they come before us, so that despite what they think, I don't arbitrarily say 50 feet from everything, but. Sometimes I do have legitimate reasons why I say 50 feet.
And I think they are those misconceptions I was alluding to earlier about the center. And we had hoped to have the opportunity to be involved in the discussions, the dialogue about the pollution control strategies, but we were excluded from those discussions after our initial work on them.
Anything else, gentlemen, for these folks?
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you both very much. Anything else for good of the order?